young Mark, be turning your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 1. 1 Samuel chapter 1. I want to do a little bit of math with you, a little bit of history before going into the book of Samuel and talk a little bit about where we are as far as the books of the Bible and where we are time-wise. I want you to think about three important dates, one of which is 1,000 years B.C., 1,500 years B.C., 2,000 years B.C., and I'm going to say 2,500 B.C. According to biblical numbers, the flood occurred just before 2,500 years before Christ. Abraham lived in the time period around 2,000 years before Christ. Moses lived in a period of time around 1,500 years before Christ. And King David lived about 1,000 years before Christ. I started learning, or I guess I did learn some years ago when I first started preaching, that a lot of the people who had taught classes, especially ladies, knew every one of these Bible stories in intricate detail. They knew them a lot better than I did. And on a pretty regular basis, I'd be in the process of telling an Old Testament story, and they'd be nodding their head, and then all of a sudden, and I knew that I got off somewhere. But what I found was they really didn't have the ability to put them in chronological order because they never thought about it like that. David, there were three kings in the United Kingdom. This is the kingdom. King Saul was the first, David was the second, and Solomon was the third. All three of these men ruled exactly 40 years. David's time as king split the 1,000-year mark. So we have him being king from 1020 to 980 time period. Solomon from 980 to 940, and we have King Saul from 1060 to 1020. The period of time we call the Judges, which was about 250 years, stopped at the period of time when Saul became the king, which was about 1,060. So you can go back and take a look at somewhere around 1,300 years B.C. is when the period of time of the Judges. The story of 1 Samuel actually is he was the last judge. He's not considered one of the judges. His name's not in the book of Judges, but you're going to see in 1 Samuel chapter 7 that his primary job, not only being a prophet, was a judge. In looking at this, we have, as I've shown you many times, 5:12, 5:12. These are the books of history. They start with the book of Joshua, the book of Judges, the book of Ruth in chronological order, and 1 Samuel. This is where we are. So we're studying the history right now. The books of history, there are 12 total. And again, Joshua was the oldest one. Coming into the book of 1 Samuel, all the way back here, somewhere around probably 1350 B.C., the tabernacle that was torn down and moved and built up again and torn down and moved and built up again, was moved to a place called Shiloh. It remained in Shiloh from somewhere around 1350 B.C. all the way over here till the time that Solomon built the actual temple, which was around 960, we believe, something in that range, 960 to 970. So for 300 years, actually 400 years, people did not worship. They did not come annually to Jerusalem, where the temple would eventually be built. There were three temples in time. But they moved, they worshiped in a place called Shiloh. Initially, people believed that they had just fortified, they had put walls around the tabernacle that had been used during the time, all the time that Moses in the wilderness wanderings. Somewhere along the way, a permanent building was built in Shiloh, and that's where the people worship. So this morning, this afternoon rather, we're going to be reading about the temple. They were in the temple. Eli was in the temple. It even says that he slept in the temple, which was obviously some room off to the side of it, much like Samuel as a little boy. This was not one of the three temples in the Bible. So this was something else that was a temporary place until Solomon built the actual temple. Now with that in mind, I want you to turn with me to the book of 1 Samuel chapter 1. There was a man, his name was Elkanah. You can see that in the verse 1, and he had two wives. One of his wives had multiple children. She had sons, plural, and daughters, plural. But his wife, Hannah, was barren. She wanted a child more than anything in the world, and she couldn't have a child. The wife that had the children, her name was Peninnah, I guess, or Peninnah, however you want to pronounce that, would constantly taunt Hannah. Look in verse 6. This is chapter 1 and verse 6. Her rival, however, would provoke her bitterly to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. And it happened year after year, as often as she went up to the house of the Lord, that she would provoke her, so she wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to Hannah, "Why do you weep, and why do you not eat, and why is your heart sad? And am I not better to you than 10 sons?" Well, that wasn't really helping what she wanted. In this day and time, having a son for your husband was the most important thing, maybe to women outside of their relationship to the Lord. You think about, why did Sarah offer her handmaiden to Abraham, and then after the son is born, she realizes, I just messed up. Now my handmaiden is the mother of the oldest child of Abraham. Well, that was so incredibly important to women. Perhaps it is still today in many cases. In verse 10, she was greatly distressed, and she prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly, and she made a vow. Now this morning we talked a good bit about the making of a vow. And what I would say to you is, we learned in the book of Ecclesiastes about when you make a vow, pay it. Don't not pay it. You don't have to make the vow, but when you make a vow, you pay it, and don't be late in paying it. She makes a vow. We don't exactly know what it is until a bit later, but I want you to look at this in verse 11. She made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou would indeed look on my affliction of thy maidservant and remember me, and not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head. This is the same Nazarite vow that we saw in Samson not long ago. You see it in a number of people. The Apostle Paul took that vow or something very similar to it in Acts chapter 18. So she is in the temple praying, and Eli's looking at her. And he's thinking, she's drunk. He comes up to her because her mouth's just moving and there's no words coming out. And he comes up to her and he says, "Why are you drunk? What's going on with you?" And she says to him, "I'm not drunk." In verse 13, Eli thought she was drunk. In verse 14, Eli said to her, "How long will you make yourselves drunk? Put away your wine from you." And Hannah answered and said, "No, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant as worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of great concern and provocation." Eli answered and said, "Go in peace, and may God of Israel grant your petition if you have asked." And so in time, she does have a child. In verse 20, it came about in due time that Hannah had conceived and given birth to a son, and she named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked him of the Lord." Oftentimes, as we talked about this morning, out of the book of Genesis chapter 2, when Adam looked at his wife and he examined her and he named her, he says, "She's bone of my bone, she's flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man, or from man." Most of the time, biblical names mean something. The word Moses means out of water or drawn from water. Today, we have a tendency of going through a book and picking out, it seems to me, the most unusual, unique name that really doesn't mean anything to anybody. I guess, but it does to the person, that the child that gets it eventually. That was not true in biblical times. In verse 23 and 24, we find something out, and that is, the vow was, I'm going to keep this child at home. I'm not going to make this long trip up to Shiloh. I'm going to keep the child at home until I wean him. And once I wean him, I'm going to carry him to Eli, the high priest, and he's going to live with him forever, and he will never come home with me. That's the vow that she made, and she kept that vow. We talked about this morning in class that she had the right to basically redeem that vow, but she was concerned about it and would not do it. And so this boy, Samuel, from the time he was 3 years old, he lived with Eli, the high priest. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this is Eli has two sons. And you can see in verse 3, chapter 1 and verse 3, it says that Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas were priests to the Lord there. So his two sons were not high priests, but they were priests. And they took part of helping people offer their sacrifices day by day. In verse chapter 1 and verse 27, for the boy I prayed, and for this boy I have prayed, and I have given my petition which I ask of him, so I have dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord, and they worship the Lord there. And that's how this little boy Samuel ended up living with the high priest Eli. In chapter 2 and verse 12, we have, to me, what is one of the most incredible things that you can imagine. How could two priests who were living with their daddy being the high priest, and daily they were in the tent of meeting and they were offering sacrifices, and we have this phrase in chapter 2 and verse 12. The sons of Eli were worthless men, and they did not know the Lord. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. It would be impossible. It would be absolutely impossible for them not to know who God was. It would have been impossible for them not to know all the stories about God. It would have been impossible to say that they didn't know who he was. What this says is they had no respect for him or no regard for him. Because of that, they were doing things that were incredibly sinful and disgusting. Here was a common thing. It was a very common thing for them to have a meat pot, very large meat pot, and might have pieces of fat on it, and the meat would be put in there and boiled for a period of time. But before someone ate it, you would stick in a big fork and you would pull it out and you would put it over the fire until all the fat was burned away, because it was sinful for them to eat fat. We probably ought to think about that today, myself certainly included. No, they didn't want that. They didn't want that. I don't want that. I want it coming right out of the pot. I want the fat and everything, and I want to eat all of it. That was a thing that they commonly did, and it was a sinful thing. In addition to that, we are told that they slept with women in the temple, in the tent of meeting. So you can see in verse 14, this is chapter 2 and verse 14, he would thrust it into the pan. This is the three-pronged fork that they had, or kettle, or cauldron, a pot, and the fork which brought up, the priest would take it for himself. Thus they did in Shiloh to all Israelites, the Israelites. And before they burned the fat, the priest's servants would say to the man who was sacrificing, give the priest meat for roasting. Well, they wanted it beforehand. In verse 17, thus the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for the men despised the offering of the Lord. Every once in a while today, you hear about a preacher, maybe even a gospel preacher, who is caught having an affair with someone in the congregation, or who has some horrible other life over here, maybe that nobody knew about, and it came flying out as a pretty disgraceful thing. And you think, well, I guess that's just a product of our time. I'm telling you, they were wicked priests and wicked preachers from the beginning of time. They were human beings, and some of them were good, and some of them were as sorry as could be. One of the amazing things, and I'm going to go forward a little bit to our next story. So you see this young boy Samuel growing up. Because of how ungodly Eli was viewed by God, God would no longer talk to him and had not talked to him for most of his life. That's why he was communicating with this little boy Samuel. So Samuel watches these worthless boys of Eli who grew up and became and were basically killed because of their worthlessness. Samuel, when he is an old man in chapter 8, I want you to look at something with me. So after witnessing that and seeing that, what kind of father was Samuel when he became an adult? In chapter 8 in verse 1, it came about when Samuel was old, he was appointed judges over Israel. The name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second Abihah. They were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. You want to know why the people were crying, "Give us a king, give us a king, give us a king"? Because they had had two generations of the men who should have been the godliest men in the world who had worthless sons. Not only Eli, but then Samuel after him. Now, we are not told, like we are with Eli, that Samuel was the cause of it, but whatever happened, he had pretty well worthless sons too. And taking a look now in verse 22, eventually Hannah has more children. You can see in verses 20 and 21, Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord give your children to this woman in the place of the one who's dedicated." Then they went their way home, and the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to three sons and two daughters. I'm assuming that that's three sons in addition to the little boy Samuel, and two daughters. And the boy Samuel grew up before the Lord. Verse 22, Eli was very old and heard all that his sons were doing in Israel and how they lay with the women who served in the doorway of the tent of meeting. Now that's pretty incredible, isn't it? So he begins trying to reason with his sons. We talked this morning about something, and I want you to consider it. Because most of us here are old enough, or a good many people sitting here are old enough to be aware of this. By the time children are 40, 50, 60 years of age, they tend to be pretty well set in their ways, aren't they? Now, they still have the ability, if a person's living and breathing, they still have the ability to come to the Lord. I had a wonderful conversation with someone this morning that I've known all of my life who tells me he wants to be baptized. That's very exciting to me. He's north of 60 years of age. But by and large, that doesn't happen. That's why in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, it says, "Remember the Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the time draws near when they say, I have no interest, I have no concern about God." Eli is 99 years old. His children are probably somewhere in this range. And he now begins telling them, "You've messed up. Why did you do this?" Well, they're not going to change. There's been too much water going to the bridge. But in verse 22, he was very old. And all of his sons, he heard all his sons were doing in Israel. And what's interesting, when we come to chapter 3, it's going to say, "You were the responsible for this, Daddy, Eli, because of the things that your children did and you knew about it and you didn't rebuke them." Now, when he's old, all of this stuff is coming to him. He obviously knew that these boys were on the wrong track for a long time, or he would not have been punished and held accountable by God. So what happens now is he is hearing all this stuff, and before he passes from this life, he feels like, "I've got to make one more plea. I've got to talk to my boys." So in verse 22, verse 23, "And he said to them, why are you doing such things, the evil things that I hear from all the people?" It's pretty clear that their reputation was terrible. Now, it's interesting, sometimes when the children have classes and they learn about, "Oh, the people wanted a king like all the nations round about." What they don't sometimes, probably don't teach in the children's stories, is what was happening beforehand, which was human error, is why the people thought a king would be preferred. Look at the priest that they had, these boys. And then look at Samuel afterward. So he says in verse 24, "No, my sons, for this report is not good, which I hear that the Lord's people are circulating." It was known. Everybody knew what kind of worthless people they were, but they were still offering sacrifices and working in the temple. In verse 25, if one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, when you're in the Lord's house, you're offering sacrifices for the Lord's people. When you sin against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death. Why did he want to put them to death? Because they wouldn't listen. There should have been, according to what God saw with Eli, a lot more work down here when they were 5 years of age, 10 years of age, 15 years of age. Saying this now didn't have anything, really have any impact on anything. Then we have in this story a messenger of God, a prophet that comes to Eli. And he says to him, Eli, get your business together. Because God's going to kill your two boys pretty soon. They're young, but God's going to take their lives. And oh, by the way, he's going to take yours too at the same time. So what happens in verse 27, the man of God came to Eli and said to him, thus saith the Lord, did I not indeed reveal myself to the house of your fathers when you were in Egypt in bondage in Pharaoh's house? So Eli's father, grandfather, his people had been high priests for a long, long period of time. In verse 28, did I not choose them from the tribes of Israel to be my priests, to go up to my altar, to burn incense and carry the ephod before me? And did I not go to your house, the father of the fire offerings, the sons of Israel? Why did you kick at my sacrifice? Why was it not important enough to you to get this right, we might say? And at my offering, which I commanded in my dwelling, honor your sons above me by making yourself fat with the choicest, even the offering of my people Israel. The charge that God makes is this. You valued your sons more than you did me. You allowed them to do things that were sinful in order to make yourself wealthy by selling things and by doing things to make wealthy. So he says, the sin that Eli committed that he's charging him with is not that you weren't a good daddy. What he charged him with was you put your boys above God. Now look a little bit further at what he's going to tell him now. And I want you to look at that verse again in verse 29. I have commanded, and you honor your sons above me by making for yourselves fat with the choicest of offerings of my people in Israel. Therefore, the Lord of God of Israel declares, I did indeed say that your house and the house of your father should walk before me forever. That was my plan, God said. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. I'm not going to take care of you anymore. Verse 31, but the days are coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's house so that there will not be an old man in your house. Not him or not any other old men going forward. And you will see the distress, verse 32, of my dwelling in spite of all that I do for Israel, and an old man will not be in your house forever. Yet I will cut off every man of yours, my altar, that your eyes may fail from weeping, and your soul will grieve, and all the increase of your house will die in the prime of life. Because you put your boys ahead of me, because you thought that it's exactly what the Apostle Paul said to Timothy. 1 Timothy 6, some who assume that godliness is a source of great gain. That's exactly what Eli's boys had done, and he didn't stop it. Verse 34, this will be a sign to you, and which shall come concerning your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. On the same day both of them will die. But I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul, and I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before my anointed always. And it shall come about that everyone who is left in your house shall come and bow down to him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread and say, please assign me to one of the priest's offices that I may eat a piece of bread. It would be ripped from them. It's going to be going to this little boy, Samuel. In verse 3, there's an interesting thing that I want you to... Chapter 3. The high priest oftentimes would receive information from God. God would show them things in visions and dreams. You saw that in the time of Aaron, who was the first high priest. So when you see in chapter 3 and verse 1, there was no communication from God for a long period of time. You recognize it was because he didn't respect Eli, and he certainly didn't respect Eli's voice. So in chapter 3 and verse 1, the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent. I want to stop for a minute. This comes into play when this little boy is asleep and he hears a voice. And he wakes up and he runs into Eli and says, Eli, you want something? No, I didn't call you. So it happened three different times. Now here's what's happened. Samuel has never heard the voice of God. Eli, who's 99 years old, hadn't heard it in a long, long time because of the way he had acted and his voice. That's why there was some confusion as to where the voice was coming from. Who is this? So look in verse chapter 2 and verse 2. It happened at the time as Eli was lying down in his place. Now his eyelid had begun to grow dim and he could not see well. So verse 3, the lamp of the Lord had not yet gone out. That's meaning he wasn't blind yet, but he was pretty close to it. Verse 4, the latter part of verse 3, Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. So on several occasions, this is called the ark of the Lord. In the fourth chapter, you're going to see that the ark of the covenant, or the house of God, or the temple. The ark of the covenant was here, you'll see in chapter 4. But this was not the temple that Solomon built. That wouldn't come about for something around 400 years. This was some temporary structure that was built or fortified from the old tabernacle. And Owen and I were talking about this morning. If you were to Google this, you're going to find out. If you think that Samuel was like sleeping in front of the Ark of the Covenant, that was not the case. There no doubt were rooms around this that were their residence or their place where they lived. Eli lived and his boys lived and Samuel lived. So when he says in verse 3 that he was lying down in the temple where the ark of God was, he was somewhere in that building. In verse 4, the Lord called Samuel and said, and he said, here am I. And he ran to Eli and he said, here am I, for you called me. But he said, I did not call, lie down again. And he went and lied down. And the Lord called yet again, Samuel. And Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, here I am, for you called me. But he answered and said, I did not call you, my son. He lied down again. Samuel did not know that the Lord, the word of God, had yet been revealed to him. He hadn't figured that out yet. So in verse 8, the Lord came to Samuel a third time, and he arose and went to Eli and said, here I am, for you've called me. Then Eli discerned that the Lord was calling the boy. But let's stop for a minute. The background story to this is important. Why were there visions and the voice of God had not been heard from Eli by Eli for a long time? It was because God had lost respect for Eli and for his sons. He was not communicating with him. And so now when this happened, it took Eli a while to figure out, this has got to be God. I mean, there's nobody else here. I'm not calling him. So verse 9, Eli says to Samuel, go lie down, and it shall be if he calls you that you shall say, speak, Lord, for thy servant is listening. So Samuel went up and lay down in his place, and the Lord came and stood and called as the other time, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel said, speak, for thy servant is listening. And the Lord said to Samuel, behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears will tingle. In that day I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. Now, he's already told Eli, we saw that before, that you're going to die, your boys are going to die on the same day, and no old person, no, there's never going to be a man grow to be old in your house, and your people are going to basically be begging from the next high priest because you tried to enrich yourself. So he's now putting a heavy message on this little boy. So in verse 13, for I have told him, we read that I'm about to judge his house forever. It wasn't just that he's an old fat man and he's going to fall over backwards in his chair and break his neck. It wasn't that when his boys carried the Ark of the Covenant out to battle that it was captured and they were killed on that day. He says, I'm judging your house forever. Very much like he told King Saul. I am ripping away from you the kingship forever and giving it to another man. David, it would be David's family that would be the kings in perpetuity. So he was judging Eli's house forever for this, his lifestyle, if you will, and his choices. And therefore, in verse 14, I have sworn to the house of Levi, the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. This morning, I spent a little bit of time talking about discipline versus punishment. When discipline does not work, the next path is always punishment. Punishment is never, in God's eyes, about the person receiving it. The person receiving the punishment from, I don't care if it's the nation of Israel, to Sodom and Gomorrah, to the people living in the time of Noah and the flood, or Eli's house. When discipline does not work, punishment is next. And there is no ending to this. And what he's saying is, in regard to punishment, I don't care how many sacrifices you give me, Eli. I don't care what you do in the remaining days of your life. I've already made this decision, and I'm not changing my mind. So there would be no sacrifices atoned for forever. Verse 14, Samuel lie down until morning. I've thought about this many times. Can you imagine a child who's 3, 4, 5 years of age, who his mother has carried him up here to Eli, and Eli is the closest thing to a daddy he has, and this message comes to him and says, I'm going to kill Eli, and I'm going to kill Hophni and Phinehas, and you need to go tell him that you know it. Is that a heavy load on a little boy like that? In verse 15, Samuel lay down until morning, and he opened the doors of the house of the Lord, but Eli was afraid Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. So Eli knows now that Samuel has had a conversation with God. And he opens the door from where he's sleeping, and Eli sees him, and he's scared to death to tell Eli what God's put on him. Well, Eli needs to know, and he wants to know. So what happens next is in verse 16, then Eli called Samuel and said, Samuel, my son. And he said, here am I. And he said, what is the word that he has spoken to you? Now stop for a minute and realize that back in chapter 2, the prophet of God has come to Eli and given him the scoop. And that is, you're going to die, your boys are going to die, it's going to happen on the same day, you can't do anything about it, and I'm telling you, I'm ripping the priesthood, which has been in your family all the way back to the time of Aaron, back here, several hundred years, I'm taking it away from you, and there's nothing you can do now. Why was that? It was because he knew that his boys were doing things, he didn't rebuke them, he didn't try to change it, and God said, you put your family above me. That could not be tolerated by the number one man of God on the planet. Well, verse 17. So he's now saying to Samuel, Samuel, what did God tell you about me? And he said, what is the word that he has spoken to you? Please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more if you're hiding anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you. It was serious to Eli. What did Samuel know? What was about to happen? Now, The commentators would tell you Eli was wondering, are me and my boys going to die today, tomorrow, or is it going to be 10 years? He wanted more information on when all this was going to happen. So he says to Samuel, don't you hide anything from me. You tell me everything you know. I need to know what God told you. In verse 18, God and Samuel told him everything. And hid nothing from him, and he said, it is the Lord. Let him do what he seems good to him. Now, I want you to think about this. So Eli now, he has laid his heart. He's told him every single thing. And so now Eli has what the prophet of God has told him about his future. He now has what God personally has said to this little boy, Samuel. And Samuel lays this heavy load on him. And now he has a very full picture, a clear picture of what his future looks like. And his future is only days away. Perhaps the next day. So this little boy Samuel was given a pretty tough job. In verse 19, Samuel grew and the Lord was with him and let none of his words fail. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared to him again in Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Compare this to verse 1. Verse 1, where it says, the word of the Lord was rare in those days, and visions were infrequent. The last verse of chapter 3 says, the Lord appeared again in Shiloh. He had not appeared to Eli for a long time, but he has now appeared again in Shiloh, telling the high priest exactly what's going to happen because this young boy Samuel has now taken the job. I want to just spend a second talking about this, but in chapter 4, I want to just spend a second looking at this. So Hophni and Phinehas decided that they were going to take the Ark of the Covenant out of the temple, and they were going to carry it out to the battlefield. Now you can remember, many of you who have studied this story, the Ark of the Covenant was to be carried. It was something pretty close to the size of what this communion table is. And down at the bottom down here, there were holes and they had long poles through it and men would carry it. Now this is why in this story coming up in chapter 6, getting ahead of myself a bit, they're taking the Ark of the Covenant out to the battlefield thinking it's going to help them win the battle. They are destroyed by the Philistines, the very people that were pretty much put down in Samson's day, and they captured the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was then carried into the house of Dagon, which was their god. And the first day, the next morning, when the priest of Dagon came in, Dagon, who was a dog head, you've seen that before, and he had hands like this, he was laying over as if he were bowing down to the Ark of the Covenant. And they helped pick this god back up, their god back up, and they moved the Ark of the Covenant up. The next morning when they came in, Dagon had been burst to pieces. Eventually, they will put the Ark of the Covenant on a cart, and they will send it back across the line, back to where it came from. It ends up in a town where nobody knew what it was. And in chapter 6, what you're going to see is, you begin taking a look at this, in verse chapter 6 and verse 19. I'm just giving you a quick overview. So now the Ark of the Covenant, who has been put on a cart, carried by a couple of milk cows, comes across the line back into Israel, and they don't know what it is. So they make the decision, some of the men, to pry the lid open to the Ark of the Covenant. Take a look in chapter 6 and verse 19. He struck down some of the men of Beth-Shemesh because they looked into the Ark of the Lord. He struck down of all the people 50,070 men, and the people mourned down to, because the Lord had struck them with a great slaughter. And the men of Beth-Shemesh said, who is able to stand before this God, the Holy One, and to whom shall he go up? For they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath Jerem saying, the Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it. 50,000 people, because they pried the ark, the lid, the mercy seat, off the Ark of the Covenant. You remember the first time it was carried, when a man reached up and touched it to try to stay it, and he was struck dead because of that? You just imagine when people try to pry the lid open or the door open. Now I want to finish with one last thing, and I want to go back to chapter 7. Chapter 7. This is a sad story to me. When this little boy, Samuel, God was so happy with him and so pleased with him, and he became the high priest. And God loved him, and God did every single thing he promised Samuel that he would do. And Samuel was a great judge, and you can see the latter part of chapter 7. Chapter 7 and verse 15. Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he used to go annually on a circuit from Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all these places. Then his return was to Ramah, for his house was there, and he judged Israel, and he built an altar to the Lord there. And then you see in chapter 8 in verse 3, his sons did not walk in his ways and turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. Which was very similar to what Eli's boys did. How did that happen? Now, we're not told in this case that it was Samuel's fault. But can you imagine how heartbreaking it was for Eli and for Samuel to spend their life as a high priest and then see their boys, who basically viewed God and God's people as a source of gain? It's a sad situation. And I've used this example. I've heard gospel preachers say, if you were to take a look at this circuit that Samuel would go on and how many days he had to be gone from his house, he probably wasn't home enough to be a very good father. Well, that may be. But it's not in Scripture. So I don't know what happened. Every one of us struggle with our children. Why did our children end up the way they did? Why weren't they better? Why did this child do this? I've got two kids, and one of them's faithful to the Lord, and one of them's not. And they were raised in the same house. They ate the same food. Why is it I have five kids, and three of them are faithful, two are not? And I don't know all the answers to that. I do know that there are times that we are specifically told that the parents were at fault. There are times we're specifically told the parents were not at fault. In this case, you can judge for yourself why Samuel's two boys were worthless. But it was that. It was the two generations before that made the people say, we want a king. We want a king like everybody else. What God has for us isn't working. And it was human error. It was not God's error that Eli's boys turned out the way they did and Samuel's boys. Thank you for listening to me. We have a song that Brother Byron is going to lead us in that will be our song of encouragement. What is the number of that? 280. So we'll ask you to stand at this time, and anyone that might need to make response, let it be known as we stand together and sing.